And then you have to deal with.
Do the real stuff.
Yeah.
Good morning. So nobody brought breakfast this morning? What's going on? My name is Councilwoman Jacoby Pittman, and I represent District 8. And I want to thank you all for signing up and attending our second meeting for critical quality of life with the focus on affordable housing and workforce housing. It is indeed an honor for me and my co-chair here, Dr. Jaffe, who has completed a lot of research on affordable housing, and he understands the data and the crisis and our community. I think every time we turn on the television, we realize that we see information on affordable housing crisis in our community. And over the next 4 months, we will discuss and have a frank conversation about affordable housing and who it's now affecting in our community. Together, we will bring panelists and voices to have the real conversations, which affect our community locally, on a statewide and national level. We will establish a framework and provide presentations for a final report that would include our meetings, evaluations, systems, solutions, recommendations for our deliverables, and have a final report of what our community needs and what we really have appetite. I want y'all to say that word, appetite. Okay, y'all don't say it like you mean it. Let's say it, appetite. To make impactful, transformational changes in our community. And for those of you who are here for the first time, our charge from our council president, Terrence Freeman, and our council member, Michael Boylan, who is with us this morning, has oversight of all of the committees to address the three issues that plague our community. And I'm sure we have the choir here this morning, so we don't really need to talk a whole lot. We need to do a whole lot in order to come up with solutions regarding affordable housing. We're going to talk about the homelessness and also some healthcare issues over the 3 to 4 months. Our committee has been extended an extra 30 minutes. Did anybody notice that? Did anybody else? Raise your hand if you did. Because you know we're going to need some time to talk about that. And I want to thank Michael for allowing us the 30 minutes and give him an opportunity to really talk about what he's heard so far. And then we're going to get started.
Thank you, Councilmember Pittman. I appreciate you and Dr. Jaffe for your leadership on this. And I want to recognize the Northeast Florida Regional Council who are helping us in documenting and crafting the plan. We're here to listen. The intent of creating these working groups, I see the role of the council in this process as conveners, getting folks like you who know and who live this work each and every day here to help us understand what's best. Again, the three questions we're looking to be asked, number one, what is the scope of the issue? And that's the focus of today's conversation. Next time, what's being done in our community to address the issue, both in both the private, public, and nonprofit sector? And then lastly, as Councilmember Pittman suggested, that we want to see some evidence-based recommendations coming out of this work. I will tell you, you have a task ahead of you for a variety of reasons. Yesterday, we hosted the two working group meetings for our access to health care as well as for the homeless issue. Both of those were very productive, and I think we saw a lot of good information coming out of both of those. And that's really what, and today's about setting the foundation, understanding the scope. And if I could take a look at the agenda real quick, I see that, and I do appreciate that Dr. Jaffe is going to be making a presentation momentarily. But this is not the only lens. So following his presentation, where it says Q&A, I am hopeful, as we did with yesterday, as we did with the access to health care, we had individuals who are working in the field of these areas to offer their perspective of the challenges as they see it. So I think that's really important for us to make sure that we have that opportunity today, Madam Chair, if we could, to let others then offer their perspective as to what they see as the scope and the depth of the issue. I appreciate, again, the opportunity. I can't thank you all enough for being here. A number of folks from the private sector is here. I think that's critical in this process. This is not going to be a solution that's going to be done strictly within the public and nonprofit sectors. So having them at the table and understanding the challenges they face and doing what they do is going to be important to this process. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Absolutely. Thank you. We're now going to go around and have everyone up front introduce themselves, and we'll start on my left.
Hello, everyone. My name is Marcus Lloyd. I am a regional planner with the Northeast Florida Regional Council.
Good morning. Noelle Como, Director of Planning for the Northeast Florida Regional Council.
Good morning to everyone. Tyrona Clark Murray, Council Representative for District 9.
And I want y'all to give her a round of applause because this is one of our first meetings. Thank you for being here.
David Jaffe, Professor of Sociology and Director of the Jack's Rental Housing Project.
And y'all already know me, Councilwoman Jacoby Pittman.
Good morning, everyone. Dwayne Alexander, Jacksonville Housing Authority.
And Michael Boylan, District 6.
Okay, well, we're getting ready to get started. I'd like to read the bios of our panelists today, And our first speaker we will have is Dr. Jaffe, who is a professor of sociology in the Department of Sociology, Anthropology, and Social Work. He teaches courses in introductory sociology, political sociology, international development of social work, and data analysis. Dr. Jaffe's research writings and publications are in areas of social and economic development, political economy, work and organization, and higher education. He received his PhD in sociology from the University of Massachusetts, and he is currently directing the Jacksonville Rental Housing Project at UNF. Secondly, we will have Dwayne Alexander, who is the president and CEO of the Jacksonville Housing Authority. Mr. Alexander is recognized in the industry as a leader known for his ability to implement strategies for organizational excellence. He has over 30 years of professional management experience and 20 years of working in the public and private housing in higher roles. He currently serves as the president, as I said earlier, of the Jacksonville Housing Authority. He's previously had positions as the deputy executive director of the Southern Nevada Regional Housing Authority, deputy director of the Montgomery Housing Authority, and also has worked as the chief of staff in the Virgin Islands. Welcome. And our other speaker is Lindsay McLean, who has been in the apartment industry since 2007. When she went looking for an apartment in Orlando and ended up with a place to live and job in the leasing office. That's a great story, right? Since then, she has worked in full spectrum of housing for affordable tax credit communities and luxury communities as well. In 2012, she began focusing on marketing and joined the apartmentguide.com as a sales representative. That job brought her to Jacksonville and led her to get involved with the First Coast Apartment Association as a volunteer. She formally joined the association when she accepted the director of special events in 2015. Lindsay and her husband are happy to be raising their family in Duval County. Welcome to all of our speakers, and Dr. Jaffe, take us away.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much, Councilwoman Pittman, and I'd like to thank Councilman Boylan for inviting me to participate in this panel. I think this is a vitally important issue, and it's great to see so many people here. So I'd also like to thank everyone who took the time to show up, to attend, and hopefully to participate, because we do want your input, and that is one of the reasons why we extended the length of our meetings an extra half hour so we would have the time for people to ask questions and hopefully get some good answers. We get your input and also to have a public comment period. I'm currently directing the Jack's Rental Housing Project. We are collecting lots of data. Some of the data is being collected by other organizations, and I will give a little overview of the state of the housing situation in Jacksonville in a moment. But I would encourage all of you, if you're interested in any kind of data, we can either direct you to places where you can find it, or we can do some of the analysis as well that could provide you with what you need to make some informed decisions or to raise your level of understanding and awareness about the current situation in Jacksonville. So as a way to start, I'd like to share some data that comes from one site, organization, institute, that provides lots of good data, and that is the Harvard Joint Center for Housing Studies. And according to their data, which is the best available data on the cost burden, 30% of households in Jacksonville are cost burdened. What that means is that over 30% of their income is directed toward housing. For renters, it's an even bigger problem. We're close to 50%, according to the data. 50% of renters are cost burdened, and 23% are severely cost burdened, which means that they're spending more than 50% of their income on housing. When I talk to people and tell them that cost burden is based on 30% of their income, they often laugh at me because they say I've never, ever been close to 30% of my income devoted to housing. It always exceeds 40% and it's closer to 50%. Obviously, the cost burden varies by the income of the individual, and so it can be up to 60, 70%. We need to think about the consequences of this in terms of what decisions people have to make about what they're spending money on, what they have to cut, and what they need to survive. The other thing I'd like to say about these data is they come from 2019. The figures I've given you come from 2019. It's clear, given what we know today, that these numbers are grossly underestimated because the sharp rise in rents in particular, but also housing costs generally, have occurred basically since 2020. We see this as well at the University of North Florida. I should mention that in the past, the university has had a surplus of residential housing to the point where at one point we required all first-year students to live on campus. This was designed to presumably give them a good experience, but it also was designed to obviously fill the residence halls. So we had an excess of supply in relationship to demand. This fall, there were over 300 students on a waiting list to get into housing on campus because the apartment complexes in the area that at one time had provided them a place to live, they can't afford. So we're seeing the implications of this across the board. Some additional data. The number of zip codes in Jacksonville metropolitan area, affordable, to households making 80% of area median income of a two-bedroom apartment. In 2013, there were 8 zip codes that met this criteria. Today, there are only 4. And the 4 zip codes, which I will note in a moment, are 4 zip codes that have been targeted by institutional investors and where things are not looking good there. The rent increase, a percent rent increase for a two-bedroom apartment from 2017 to 2022 was 46%. This data comes from Zillow. You can also find this data from Redfin. From 2021 to 2022, the increase in rent for a two-bedroom apartment is 26%. This morning, I went to the Redfin data site to look at those figures. And in 2021, the average rent was $1,280, and in the summer of 2022, the most recent data is now $1,680. That's a $400 increase per month on the rental bill and an increase of 31%. Now, one of the things we're finding, at least in the apartment complexes, and we've done some case studies on these, is that there is a pattern. And if you go to our website, you can read a case study. I think it's a representative case study of what's happening. And there's a change in ownership, so the tenants will receive a letter saying the apartment complex is now under new ownership and new management, and this is the consequences of that. When you sign your next lease, the increase will be quite significant. So the one apartment complex we looked at was called the Pines of Mindanao. I don't know if anyone knows where that is. It's off Atlantic Boulevard. Laguna Point Properties is the institutional investor that bought the property. They put in a new management company, ZRS Management, and the letter to the tenants indicated that the $900 to $1,200 range for rent there has moved to $1,520 to $1,770 overnight. So what we're seeing is a, I would say, financialization of human shelter. And this is having a huge impact on the ability of people to find and afford housing in Jacksonville. And if you go to Laguna Point Properties website, they will show on their portfolio all of the apartment complexes that they've collected in their portfolio, and they're ensuring those investors who have the money to invest in this kind of thing that you will they will be generating, quote, outsized returns for our investors. One point I'd like to make, and that is that if decisions about housing are going to be driven by increasing shareholder value, we are screwed. Okay, that's the academic term to use for the situation, right? So this is a serious problem. I'm not sure how much of this can be addressed by this committee and by our policies, but I think it's significant to point this out. We also, as part of the project, wanted to do zip code analysis because the experience that people are having varies by where they live. And while a lot of the increase in the rental costs in these apartment complexes is taking place in the South Side, there are other neighborhoods that are being impacted severely as well. And in our zip code analysis, we were looking at what percent of homes are now owned by institutional investors based on the LLC designation. And what we find is that there are four zip codes that have essentially been targeted by institutional investors in the urban core. This is 32206, 32208, 32209, and 32254. These are also the zip codes that have the highest percent of non-white residents. They have the highest percent of single-family homes owned by institutional investors, and they have the highest rate of eviction filings. So we have looked at the correlation between these factors at the zip code level, and this is some of the analysis that we're doing. So that gives you some idea of what's happening with the Jack's rental housing project. Again, I encourage you to contact me if you have any stories to share. We have students who are interviewing tenants to get some qualitative data as well. And we're trying to put it all together into an extensive report, but we have put out some research briefs. So please take a look at what we've done, and we appreciate any input people have. There is a second slide. I don't think, is this?
That's the clicker.
All right. I love this. All right, I love this. Okay, so this is the only slide I have. All right, you're going to be happy to know that. I'm trying to save paper, I'm trying to save the number of PowerPoint slides, and what I try to do with this kind of diagram is take the entire story.
Take the microphone with you if you're going to walk away.
I talk loud.
Well, we need to recapture it, though.
Who wants to capture it? I'm not sure I want anyone. Okay, so what I want to do is try to capture the entire process, and maybe to some extent a conceptual framework that will drive what we're going to be doing on this committee. And that's what this diagram is designed to do. Now, it's not exhaustive. I haven't included every possible factor. I haven't included every possible stakeholder. So there are copies of this. If you didn't get one, please do. And if there are things that I've left out of this diagram, please jot it down, hand it to me, and we will expand this. We need as much input as possible to ensure that when we go through this process, we're including as many stakeholders and as many factors as possible. I would just like to start at the top left-hand, the top left-hand corner, talking about ways that people think about housing, because it's important how people think about housing has important implications on the kinds of policies they might put in place. And one of the problems I think we have in this country generally is that we think of housing as simply another commodity, something that people purchase in a market along with anything else. And they just make decisions about based on, you know, where they want to live and, you know, what kind of housing they want. But, of course, all of this is determined largely by the amount of income they have. And I think one of the reasons we're here is because we realize that housing is not just another commodity. It's a necessity. Some people would call it a human right. And therefore, I hope that we think of housing as a public good. And if we think about it as a public good, what that means is that we all have an interest in this community in Jacksonville to ensure that the citizens and the residents here are well housed, safely housed, and securely housed. That is beneficial to the entire community. That's what we mean by a public good. And so if we think about it as a public good, then the public sector has some legitimate, important role to play in ensuring that people have access to affordable, safe housing. So that's the first. The second is that the idea of people purchasing a single-family home is part of the American dream, you know, what's left of it, okay? And that means, for many people, this is the source of building wealth, right? So this is the way many people think about it. This is the way single-family home ownership has been promoted. But this does have an unintended consequence. And one of the unintended consequences is that if this is the basis on which I'm building wealth, I have to ensure that nothing is done and that I don't perceive anything to be done that will in any way threaten my property values. This is perfectly rational. I understand it, but the unintended consequence is what many of you know as NIMBYism, and that is not in my backyard. There is a movement called YIMBYism. I don't know if anyone's on board with that. It's yes in my backyard. So the idea is that when we think of housing this way, it tends to lead people to organize themselves locally and politically to oppose any kinds of policies, any kind of zoning reform that might in some way increase the supply of affordable housing, but they view that as a threat to their property values. So these are things we need to think about. That is, how do we understand, how do we think about housing, and how does that impact the way we think about policy? So I've tried to identify a series of factors here. When I create these, I create lots of these for my classes, and my students will say, "Jaffe, there's too many damn arrows." And I tell them, I say, look, the world's a complicated place, okay? There's a lot of factors involved here. There's lots of arrows, and the arrows also tell us about cause, and they tell us about consequences, and they make the important connections. So that's what I'm trying to do with this diagram. As think of this as the conceptual framework that we can work with as we move forward. And that's why I'm asking you to provide me with any additional items that you think need to be included. So clearly, there are market forces. Many people believe that the whole thing is essentially a problem with excess demand in relationship to supply. Now, Councilwoman Pittman has been kind enough to distribute the folio. I appreciate that. I need a publicist, and I think I'm going to hire you, okay, because nobody ever reads my
Just stuff. Write the check. Just write the check.
So in the folio, I do critique this idea that if we just increase the supply, it's going to solve the problem. It doesn't work that way. It works that way maybe in sort of simple-minded economics textbooks, but this is not the same kind of market we're talking about. Remember, this is housing. People need a place to live, and there is concentrated power and pricing power in this marketplace. So, but nonetheless, the relationship between supply and demand is important. It's not insignificant. I'm simply saying that we sometimes think about it in the wrong way. The financialization of institutional investors, I've already talked a little bit about that. That's critical. This is happening across the country, particularly in the Southeast and the Sunbelt cities, where you have a corporate landlord invasion. This isn't just being covered by, you know, critical sociologists like me. It is covered in every mainstream business publication that this is one of the main factors that is affecting supply and demand and prices. Obviously, the labor market is important. How much people make in Jacksonville impacts the likelihood that they will be cost burdened. And, of course, there are rising costs, and these rising costs are impacting everyone, including landlords. So we need to understand the perspective of the landlords, of the apartment owners, what kinds of costs they are incurring, and how that relates to affordable housing. Regulatory issues are critical. I did make reference to zoning. And if you look at the literature on ways to address the problem of affordable housing, zoning comes up, zoning reform comes up in almost every conversation. I just finished a wonderful book called Arbitrary Lines, which is analysis of zoning and its impact on not just prices, but class and racial segregation in almost every major American city, Jacksonville included. Building requirements, these are important as well. There are certain things that are required in every building, and the question is, do they need to be required? Is it for safety purposes? Is it for price purposes, et cetera? Tenant-landlord relations, I hope we can talk about this. I've been involved talking with other organizations about a tenant's bill of rights. These are being passed in other cities, and we have to have tenants' protections and rights expanded, recognized, and tenants need to be aware of them and the resources that are available to them in their relationship with their landlord. So that's critical. And, of course, housing costs and rent control, which is something nobody wants to talk about, but that's what I'm talking about, okay? Or maybe a moratorium on rent increases, or maybe a notification on in advance on how much your rent bill will be increasing, etc. So when I'm talking about housing costs, I'm talking about this in a very broad way. I don't think anything should be taken off the table, but I know there are some policies which some people from the very start say they will oppose, and I don't think that's the best way to begin the process. We may end there, but I don't think that's the best way to begin. Obviously, as Councilman Boylan said, the private sector is critical. Money, finance, capital, the building and construction industry, we need to hear from them. They're going to be involved, obviously, in constructing physical structures that people will be living in, and they have their own interests as well. Real estate and apartment owners and managers, we will be hearing from the, the Association of Florida Apartment.
First Coast Apartment
Association. Oh, First Coast, okay. All right, very good. So we'll give that perspective. So we're trying to invite as many different people to speak at all our meetings, and if they aren't formally on the panel, hopefully they will attend and speak when they have an opportunity. Finally, and I'm almost done.
Okay.
It's the public and nonprofit sector. Obviously, public-private partnerships are an important part of this. I've been very skeptical about public-private partnerships, I have to say, in my own research, but I know that there's no way we are going to be able to tackle this without those. But I think they need to be structured in a way that is not public cost and private benefit, which often is the net result. Housing subsidies and vouchers, I think we'll hear about some of the policies that are currently put in place by the Jacksonville Housing Authority, I hope, because they are going to play an important role. And they already have a whole array of policies, I think, in place to address this. Maybe they need to be expanded. Maybe they need more money. And there's public, social, nonprofit housing. We will be inviting people to talk about that as well. Public housing is a term that doesn't have a good reputation in the United States for reasons that are due to the way it was organized and its purpose. And in other countries, there's something called social housing. And it works very well, and it's publicly owned. And the mayor talked about a community land trust. I think some of you are familiar with this. That is a publicly owned land. So that is a public sector intervention into the market to ensure affordable housing. So I'm hoping that we can consider the full range of public sector interventions, nonprofit interventions. The point I make in the piece in the folio is the market is not going to solve this problem. Housing has to be protected from the market in some significant way in order for people to afford. And the last item is budgetary. That is, what kind of money is available? What kind of money can be provided by the city? Can money be reallocated? Is there one area of the budget that gets large amounts of money? What would that be? Can I say it? JSO? All right. Now, if we talk about public safety, you know, public safety is not just putting police on the street. It's also providing communities and neighborhoods with decent housing and decent infrastructure, and that costs money. So I don't know. I don't think we should take anything off the table, but I think when we talk about money coming from the city, there are additional sources of revenue that I think we could look at, and there also are ways to reallocate dollars
so that it actually addresses the issues and the problems that we hope to fix. So thank you very much for your attention, and I will turn it over to Councilwoman Pittman for our next speaker.
We will just go directly into, I'm going to turn it over to Dwayne Alexander, followed by Lindsay.
Thank you. So good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Come on, we got to do a little bit better here. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
How's everybody doing?
Good.
Oh, come on, we all stand up. Let's get some energy. We all stand up. Stand up. Loosen up. Now give yourself a round of applause. We need some energy in here. We got a major problem here, guys. We don't need some energy. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the housing authority been doing and what we have been doing to address the affordable housing issue here. I want to make it specifically clear, when we talk about the housing authority, we talk about low-income families here, the average household income in our developments are $14,000. So I want you to think about that. $14,000. And the area medium income for Jacksonville is a little bit less than $60,000. So when you think of a household income of $14,000, where can you live at? The other thing I want to make is specifically clear, if you do not address the low-income issue, then the problem with homelessness will continue to rise. You have to address the issue with low-income families. Starting forward, the topics of expanding affordable housing authority, I'm going to give you a perspective on affordable housing and a Jacksonville Housing Authority four-pronged approach of what we've been doing, affordable housing versus low-income housing, and a housing choice voucher program, expanded housing choice, and a rental assistance demonstration program, and a housing authority doing business more effective and efficiently. And also what I want to just put out there so that you all know, prior to the pandemic, the Jacksonville Housing Authority had about 8,000 people on our waiting list. So if you want to understand the full scope of need of low-income housing, we have more than 100,000 people on our waiting list. 100,000 people. That's a big need. And that 100,000 people do not include, that's the head of household. That does not include the additional members in the family. So that number can very well lead up to 200,000 or 300,000 families or individuals. So expanding affordable housing access and choice, the median rent in Jacksonville is $1,845 per month for a three-bedroom. In some cases, it's a little bit higher than that. When you look at the rents, the increase, everybody knows the story. We've been hearing it all year. We've been hearing it for the last 2 years. The rents increased by 22%. And close to 50% of all Jacksonville renters are cost-burdened. Now, you think about that. And then you'll understand the role that you play on this committee and what we need to do. We use this map here with the dark green, the neighborhoods, and the light green, the five-star, the three-star, the four-star. Basically, those are identifying properties. Some of you may already know we talk about the crisis with units. There's all close to 10,000 units that's coming online between now and the early part of next year. Out of those 10,000 units, only 78% of them are conventional. Only 18% of those units are affordable housing. The problem is what do you call affordable housing? So we don't have a crisis building units. We have a crisis building low-income housing. The Housing Authority has developed a comprehensive plan to address the existing affordable housing crisis by utilizing existing programs. Housing Choice Voucher Program, we have a VASH program. Just recently, the federal government came out with an additional $79 million for the VASH program, which is equivalent to 8,800 vouchers. So we actually have an opportunity to get more vouchers. Underneath the Emergency Housing Voucher Program, We have Jacksonville received a total of 196 vouchers, and currently we're about 40% utilizations with those vouchers. And Mainstream, we received 100 Mainstream vouchers, and we also received 78 family unification vouchers. We have about 9,100 vouchers total. We house about 40,000 families. 40,000 families. And we don't have enough vouchers, but we're definitely applying for these additional 8,800. I don't know what we may get, but we're definitely going to apply for as many as we possibly get. And also this year, the federal government came out with a new voucher, what they call the stability voucher, and they put about $43 million in those vouchers, and that came out to about 4,400 vouchers, and we're looking to apply for that, for those vouchers. So what the Jacksonville Housing Authority is basically trying to do is shed the old concept of public housing. The federal government do not appear to be putting any money back into public housing. Just 4 years ago, the national housing stock was about 1.2 million. They have diminished. It's about 970,000 units nationwide now. Now, the Section 8 program has escalated, but the public housing housing stock has decreased, and part of that is because of the 1999 Faircloth rule that stopped anyone from building any more public housing units. So you just can't build public housing units. So whatever your Faircloth was in 1999 is the maximum amount of units you can build with public housing funding. So our four-pronged approach is stabilize existing housing, acquisitions and existing properties, private-public partnership, and developments. Currently, we have worked on several of our existing properties. We have looked at some deals. We've been in the business for looking for any deals that we can acquire. We're looking for more partnerships, and we're definitely trying to develop some things. Currently, the Jacksonville Housing Authority, we manage over 30,000 units. 30,000. Sorry about that. Didn't have a coffee yet. 3,000. And we're the third largest housing authority in the state of Florida. And we just recently had a physical needs assessment, and our physical needs assessment determined that we need to spend more than $110 million over the next 1 to 5 years to stabilize our existing housing stock. And we have to extend the lifespan of those units so that we can get another 50 years out of them. Despite the $110 million in investments needed over the next 5 years, the Housing Authority maintained an average REACT score of 93. For those who don't know, that is the federal government sends out a third-party inspector to come out and inspect the properties. Typically, you hear some complaints about properties being having some issues and concerns. That's not the Jacksonville Housing Authority. We have extreme high REACT score. We put a lot of money, time, and energy into managing our properties. They are very well maintained, and currently we are one of the finalists for the Remy Award, which will be given out in October in Texas, and we are the only housing authority in the country that's up for that award based on the way we manage our properties. We do a whole lot, but next to nothing. Expanding opportunities, where the Housing Authority is actively seeking opportunities to purchase existing multifamily stock to expand the low-income affordable housing. In addition, we do provide third-party management, and we are recognized as a top-tier real estate management company. We received the AMO designation a couple years ago. We are just not a typical Housing Authority. We have changed the structure of our organization. We have a lot of real estate professionals working for us. We have some very sharp financial people working for our organization. So we don't function like a housing authority. We try to function like a true real estate organization because you have to be very nimble and very flexible in this market to be able to acquire properties out here, especially when you have all these investors coming into town. So the bottom line is the Jacksonville Housing Authority is open for business. We're looking for opportunities. We have some developers. but we're looking for other developers like to do business with the Housing Authority. If you have any options or solutions, we're open for anything as it pertains to help developing more units for our families. We have been working to continuously keep our development creations and new housing in the pipeline. We've been doing that for a period of time. We have the Jack's Urban Initiative, and we're underneath this banner. We've done close to $100 million in property improvements, and all this has happened in the last 3.5 years. So we haven't been sitting on our hands. We have been working. Over the last 3 years, we have renovated, converted public housing stock, Centennial Towers. We put about $27 million plus and 208 units. Hogan Creek, 183 units. We put $19 million in Jack's Beach. We spent over $30 million. Some of these housing stocks were very old. Our current housing stock averages 45 years old. As most of you know, the life expectancy of any property is about 50 years. We have to have an infusion of cash go back in these properties to extend the life of these properties. So with these 3,000 units, if we don't continuously put money back in these units, then the next generation won't have anywhere to go. Currently, we're in the final stages of our application process. We're going through the process right now with Standard & Poor for a rating for our bonds. We actually went through the whole entire process. They'll be on site in the next couple weeks to be able to do our interviews. So if we want to position ourselves to issue our own bonds here in Jacksonville. Affordable housing, and I have to really talk about this. When we talk about affordable housing, everybody talks about affordable housing, but it's not really affordable housing. When we talk about people with an income of only $13,000, and this continues to be a problem, every single day our lobby is full of folks putting applications in because they don't have anywhere to go because they just don't have the money and there's nothing out there affordable. The key word here is affordability. We can build all day, but if you don't build anything with that added affordability, what are you building? Because folks won't be able to afford it. The affordable housing is typically through the HCB program and tax credit. Low income is typically administered through the local housing authority and workforce housing. Folks often talk about workforce housing, but in our opinion, in our industry, workforce housing is the new low-income housing. Because if you think of the area medium income for someone in Jacksonville who only making $59,000 or $60,000, if they're making $15 an hour and their wife are making $15 an hour, then that means that they're making about $64,000 a year, which puts them over income. Think about that. I sort of talked about this a little bit. Move to the next one. Currently with our HCV program, the HCV program has been our ticket. We put about $60 million back into the economy on a yearly basis back to landlords. We spent every bit about $5+ million each month that we issue checks to landlords back in this economy, and it supports the 9,100 vouchers. Currently, here's the biggest threat with us. Currently, out of these 9,100 vouchers, we have 1,515 landlords. Think about this now. We have 1,515 landlords. 73% of them only own one unit. The other 13% owns two units. And the residual owns the rest of the units. So the biggest threat to us is that these investors come in, and I had a meeting yesterday with the landlords. The investors come in, and they want to offer them some money to sell their property. The investor buy the property, they put a couple $1,000s in there, and then they put them back on the market, and it's totally out of the reach of our clients. So we constantly look for incentives to keep those landlords on and try to attract more landlords. And if you know some landlords who are looking for some stable financing or a stable income, tell them to join the Housing Authority. threats we talk about in buying a home. So solutions is landlord's outreach, landlord incentives, and competitive payment standards. About 2 months ago, our Board of Commissioners authorized us to increase the payment standards. We often hear folks talking about the housing choice voucher is not large enough or don't have enough money on them so that they can't buy units. Well, we have 9,100 vouchers on the, well, we have 9,100 vouchers. HUD used a 2 year tool to be able to determine what our success rate is. So we have a 96% success rate that we put a voucher on the street, they have a 96% chance of finding a unit. But one of the problems is most of the folks want to be in the 06 area or the 08 area, and if they can't find anything in that area, then they say they can't find anything. But we have a 96% utilization rate and success rate, and just to help out, the Board of Commissioners gave us an additional $2 million to increase the payment standards, an additional 5% clean across the board over the 46, over the 47 area zip codes. But the fair market rates just came out in October, just August. They go into effect, October 1st. So what happens is every year the fair market rents come out October the August the 1st or sometime in August, but they're going to effect October the 1st. This year we were very fortunate because the overall fair market rents increased in over the 47 zip codes between $112 to $240 max. So that helps out folks who's looking for units. Over the last 4 years, we have converted these properties I mentioned earlier. We are driving our entrepreneurial direction. The Jacksonville Housing Authority is doing business. We're looking for deals, and we're looking for partnerships. So we're just not sitting back just waiting on any government funds. We're trying to make some things happen for our clients. Doing business more efficient, effectively. We talked about this a little bit earlier, but we have $110 million in capital needs over the next 5 years. Currently, we already earmarked $24 million to be spent. We already earmarked this money, so we are already in motion. We're trying to do some development at these properties. I talked about the fair cloth. We have about 180 units underneath our fair cloth, and we want to strategically use the fair cloth. We don't want to use the whole 180 at one property. We want to be able to build several developments and clusters of anywhere between 50 to 100 units, and then we want to be able to use the fair cloth and lots of 10s and 20s to be able to add that affordability to the property for some folks who may have a voucher to, or make that property a project base. I went through that kind of quick, didn't I? Any questions?
Well, save those for after.
Okay, good. Yeah. Thank you.
Well done.
Thank you so much, Lindsay.
First of all, thank you guys. I want to thank the council members for inviting me here today. I'm so happy to be able to discuss this really important critical issue with all of you here today. I'd also like to apologize for showing up late. It never fails. You have to give a presentation. Why wouldn't the bridge be up? So, thank you all. I'm excited to be here. So let me start with my name is Lindsay McLean. I'm the Executive Vice President of the First Coast Apartment Association here in Jacksonville. So why does that matter to you all? Well, we are a member-based organization. We represent over 105,000 apartment community units here in the six counties that make up the Northeast Florida section. Our association offers education, advocacy, and networking opportunities to our members. Our members are owners, operators, leasing professionals, maintenance professionals, and many, many more. We are part of an affiliation. Our affiliates make up the state, which is the Florida Apartment Association, and then also by extension, the National Apartment Association as well. So obviously we do have, you know, that's why we're all here, is to talk about the housing affordability issue that is facing Jacksonville. So I wanted to sort of start with some of the statistics that we have seen. We have seen a 0.9% population growth into the Jacksonville area over the last 12 months. What that means when you're looking at that, and these numbers are based off of, they were pulled on September 13th, and they're from CoStar data. That's one of considered one of the gold star sort of levels of multifamily data. What we're seeing right now across the city of Jacksonville is a 6.9% vacancy rate. So for those of you that are not familiar with what that might mean, that means for every 100 units, you've got about 6.9 or 7 units that are sitting vacant. That ultimately is a big part of what drives the cost of units and availability. If there's a lot of units available and apartment community is looking at offering concessions, they're lowering rents, they're giving away 1 month free because they're trying to get people in the door. If you have nothing to rent, the rents are going to be higher because you have no physical places to put people. Over the last 12 months, we've seen delivered units, about 4,500 units. That means those new construction units that have come into our market. This is higher than what we've seen historically. Historically, we've looked at 1,800 about on an average. Now, why does this matter? You're seeing that increase of 4,500 units coming into our market, and we're still seeing a vacancy rate of 6.9%. Traditionally, that vacancy sits around 9%. We do see it forecasted to increase, so that is giving us hope, but that is just going to be based on sort of what the trends are going to look like. Currently, what we're seeing is a supply gap of about 8,700 apartment units. I'm going to sort of go into a little bit more about what we've seen with that, but unfortunately, based on some of our research, looking forward by 2030, we're actually looking at seeing closer to a 5,700 gap of available units for our renters here in Jacksonville. I also put some of what we're seeing at the market asking rents. Currently, what we're seeing from CoStar is actually looking at about 1,500, and that's across the entire Jacksonville MSA. That's about a 5.6% change year over year. From the home sales from Redfin, you've seen about an 11.5% increase in home and single-family sales through the same time frame. Now, where is some of those rent increases coming from? And I think that's an important part of this conversation. I think none of us, you know, are ignorant to the fact that we're seeing inflation, we're seeing increased costs. Our National Apartment Association did a study where it broke down every dollar of rent that an owner receives on a property. What they see is about 17% from that dollar goes to operating costs, which are insurance, maintenance, utilities on the property. 15% of it goes to property taxes. 10% of it is going to payroll, which is your office staff, your managers, your maintenance professionals. Then you've got 38%, which goes to the mortgage, 11% in capital expenditures, which are potentially if you need a new roof, landscaping, any sort of project on your property. And then the remaining is 9%, which often needs to be reinvested into future capital expenditures. So the Florida Apartment Association has been beating the drum that we need more housing and that we need more affordable housing for many years. Starting back in 2020, we actually started doing some research as to where the cost drivers that we're seeing from affordable housing is coming from. That was our first study we launched into. We looked at the four major metros in Florida, obviously Jacksonville, Orlando, Miami, and Tampa. Then once we had that information in 2021, we dove a little bit deeper to look at maybe some potential options of how we can help to extend the affordable housing availability. And we dove into what looks at the use of property tax discounts to help stimulate construction and preservation. Again, looking at those same four major metros. And then finally this year, we have worked on a study that's actually diving into the amount of units needed for households of different incomes. So obviously, as Mr. Alexander alluded to, the house incomes with lower income levels, there's a much higher need of what we're seeing with apartments that need to be in those income levels. So we have that information, and I'll give you a preview of that today. It actually won't be released until fall of this year, but I do have some of that information to be able to share. But so starting back with the 2020 research study, we wanted to see, like I said, what you're seeing is the additional units coming in, but where is that going from? So between July of 2019 and July of 2020, Florida gained 240,000 residents. We were second only to the state of Texas as far as increased population. That's a 1% increase from 2019 when we had a 21 million as a population. Jacksonville actually had 19% more single-family homes sold in January of 21 than we did of January of 2020. So when you're seeing the new construction units that's coming or that are coming into the market, obviously part of that conversation is not many of them are affordable. Not many of them are low income. What you're seeing is a lot of luxury developments. You're seeing high-end developments. Why is that? Well, part of that is the people that are moving to Jacksonville are people with a higher income. Over 68% of the people that did move to our area actually have an income of over $100,000. So that demand is there for high luxury level of living, and that's where a lot of the additional in construction and properties that you're seeing come up are coming because they're seeing that there is a demand for that level of housing. So with that, that has changed the state's GDP, which I think is an interesting statistic. From 2010 to 2018, the state GDP has actually outpaced the national GDP, especially true in metro areas. So from 2010 to 2018, the GDP of Jacksonville was 44%. The average for the state of Florida was actually 41%. And the national United States GDP was only 37%. So you're seeing that as an increase in our area. So that's part of the fundamentals of what we're seeing is a population increase. But beyond that, there is also exclusionary zoning and historic disparities, which limit new multifamily and construction areas to certain specific neighborhoods. Land and construction costs. Since 2010, construction costs in Florida have increased almost 100%. 26% of that increase actually came since 2017. And keep in mind, this data is from 2020. So that's not even looking at the historical inflation that we've seen with construction costs from 2020 to 2022. And then also there is municipal policy or policies, which local property taxes, impact fees, project delays, overall uncertainty, which have also increased the cost of housing. This slide looks at, these are four major metros. This is Jacksonville, Orlando, Miami, and Tampa. And this is showing you what percentages of the area are actually zoned for multifamily versus single family. As you can see, Duval County has 90% of our area zoned for single family. So it's a very small percentage of our space that can actually be developed with multifamily. The multifamily is built almost exclusively along large corridors and highways or in downtown, seldom in neighborhoods. This is actually further constricting our supply, and it actually increases the premiums on new multifamily housing wherever it is actually able to be built. So, where does the cost come from in multifamily? This slide sort of breaks it down for you. What you're looking at is multifamily development can only occur where rents generated fully cover the development financing and operating costs. So what you're seeing on the left-hand side of this, the dark blue, those are your hard costs, your development costs. You have the cost of land. So there's only small amounts of land. You've purchased that amount of land, probably for a higher price because there's such small amounts of it. Now you have your hard costs, that's your construction and your building materials. And then you also have your soft costs, which are your design, your entitlements, your permits, and other non-direct construction costs. Then moving on to that, you also have your financing. And then you have your property management on top of that, which is, of course, again, the maintenance of the property, the management of the property. So what is required then to balance that out is the income that you're receiving from the property, which are the rents. So when layered with the additional municipal policies and increases that we've seen, so for example, the increase in real estate taxes by 15%, delay in projects being able to get out of the ground, the increase in impact fees or increased design review, it actually is causing what could have been a rent of around $1,650 to now be required to be in a rent of $1,896 to make that unit profitable and for that developer to be able to make that unit happen. So, from what we learned from our 2020 study, we then took that information into 2021 and said, what are some options? What can we do to try to help offset some of these issues? And what they dove into is the property tax discount. They looked at what's been utilized in many different states successfully and looked at some options of what could be used here in the state of Florida to help spur and increase affordable and workforce housing. Carefully designed tax discounts can actually provide additional housing capacity and stimulate local economies. Tax discounts work in two ways. The first one is considered a direct approach. It provides discounts in exchange for rents at certain affordabilities. So, for example, if you had a 250-unit property, if there was a 25% property tax discount that was offered to them, they would be required then to, say, designate 10% of that property to be considered affordable or workforce housing, which is what we consider about 60% of the average median income. So if you're looking at an average rent in Jacksonville, about $1,500, 60% of that puts you down around, what, $900? So of that 250-unit building, 25% of those would be forced to be offering rents at around that $900. So 25 families would be able to be housed at that 60% AMI. The other option would be the supply approach, which is actually looking at increasing the overall supply of housing by providing discounts for an entire property. It increases the supply, also indirectly lowering or maintaining rents for other established properties. And you can see here from the graphs, this is sort of just putting that same information into a visual. On the left, you have all of your hard costs, your taxes, your operations, your financing. On the right, again, you've got your supporting rents that match what your expenses are. And you can see in that grayed up part, that's your feasibility. When you can remove some of that cost, some of those taxes, that drops down your feasibility, and now you're able to offer a lowered rent to be able to still make that discount or that development make sense. So now this does say Orlando. As I mentioned, the study does look at the four major metros, and they did just break out Orlando in this one, but I think it's not hard for us to imagine this is similar numbers to what we would see in Jacksonville. But what they're looking at is the average household in Orlando earning 60% of median income, which they found to be about $39,900, is currently paying 40 to 50% of their income on housing. That is considered a burdened household, as been mentioned previously up here. Anytime you're spending more than a third of your income, it is considered a cost-burdened household. If that household had an affordable unit with rent that was less than a third of their total income, they would actually look at be saving about $15,300 annually. So this sort of breaks it down a little bit further about how that works. Property taxes are one of the primary sources of revenue for a local government. It comprises on average about a third of the total government's revenue. Now this is just, again, an example. In Miami-Dade, with the densest multifamily properties, residential developments with more than 10 units actually accounted for only 8% of the total taxable residential value, and of that, only 5.5% of all taxable value. So the point that I'm making here is that multifamily is actually a very small percentage of the property taxes that are garnered by the local government. In Jacksonville, 34% of the revenue for COJ is from property tax revenue, and multifamily actually accounts for less than 1% of that tax revenue in Jacksonville currently. Most of the savings resulting from the discounted rent would be reinvested locally, so those families that have that additional money would be able to reinvest that money locally, and that would incur sales tax, which would also help to even out sort of that general revenue generation, and the net change in total would be less by offering that property tax discount to those families than what the actual government would be looking at potentially losing as foregone property revenue. And again, this is sort of, you know, as Dr. Jaffe mentioned, you've got arrows. So the household savings on rent would be used in increased jobs, increased earnings, increased economic activity, as well as increased sales tax revenue. This one breaks it down with some actual numbers. Now, this was a pro forma, so it's an example case study that was created for what this would look like, again, based on a property tax discount of 25% for a building with 10% set aside for rents below the market rate. So again, for those ones that are sitting at a 60% AMI. For the annual savings for the families per each building, annualized, you're looking at $335,000. What that tax property discount would encourage would be actually 3,500 new units in the market. 350 of those would be set aside as affordable and workforce housing at that 60% AMI. It would increase potentially 56 jobs, $2.4 million in increased earnings, and an ultimate increase in economic activity of 6.2%, or 6.2 million. I use words, I promise. As this, the property tax discount, it provides a range of benefits to municipalities, the state, the building owners, and the households. At the municipal and metro level, also, they can operate as a ground-up housing development. It's a tool in the toolbox that a local municipality can use to help spur on affordable and tax credit development. At the state level, like I mentioned, you're looking at potentially increased sales tax revenue because people would have those additional revenue that they wouldn't be spending on rent. They can spend it on other things, childcare, you know, goods and services, food, everything like that. You've got building owners. This would encourage developers and building owners to potentially develop new buildings that they wouldn't have otherwise because that property tax discount exists. And then for households, which I think is the most important part, the rent savings through the access to the affordable units would actually give them essentially a 30% raise in their income because that's reducing the amount of money that they would be spending on rent. The creation of affordable and workforce housing in the market rate buildings actually could be an initial step to support more inclusive communities. Housing segregation has affected access to transportation, education, and employment opportunities, and quality healthcare, and it continues to impact our areas where new housing developments are occurring today. The tax discounts to create affordable and workforce housing as part of the mixed-income buildings and mixed-income communities could offer a useful tool to support access to affordable housing in neighborhoods with the greatest demand and increased opportunities. So, as I mentioned, we have our brand new research study, which I understand it's a little bit hard to see from here, but I did want to give you guys sort of a preview on this. What you're seeing in the blue on the left is our current supply housing gap. The further you go to the left, the lower the income rate that we're looking at, the lower the annual income rate is for a family. You can see as we go to the right, so the higher the income rate is, there is more of available units for them. Overall, it averages out to we still have a shortage of about 5,700 apartment units right now. And unfortunately, though, when you really dive into that data, again, what you're looking at is on the lower income families, that shortage actually is closer to about 2,500 units that we need right now to be able to house lower income families. And then this research actually looks forward as well. So this is looking forward as a snapshot to what would look going forward into 2030. And going forward, we're actually seeing, you can see that there is still an increased gap of housing supply that we would have that we need to focus on rectifying now so that we're not further down the road in a bigger problem. This map, again, sort of is a bigger version. You can see it a little bit better. Everything in the light gray is single family. Everything in orange is multifamily. So you can see the locations where right now multifamily can develop. There are very few parts of town that are available for that. It's less than 10% of the county that can currently be developed. In addition to that, many neighborhoods do remain opposed to multifamily housing. As Dr. Jaffe also mentioned, NIMBYism is something that we see where, not in my backyard, people all believe that we need more housing, we need more affordable housing, but they don't want it to be built anywhere near them. So there's this belief that additional housing would lower the cost of home values by having increased density in an area that could potentially lower the value of homes. So, as I mentioned, we have beat this drum for years now on the local level, the state level, and the federal level that we need more housing. We need to do everything we can to create thoughtful and balanced housing policies. FAA and FCAA have and will continue to advocate that, and we are very happy to be a part of this conversation. We recognize this is a very significant problem, and we are looking forward to being a part of the conversation to find some solutions. So thank you all very much.
Wow. Let's give all of our panelists a big round of applause. And I tell you, Councilman Borland, I think it's going to take more than 4 months. We have some serious issues. But the good thing that we're able to have dialogue, there has been a lot of information here today. And before we continue discussions, I really like for you all to ask questions of all of our panelists now, and we can then open it up for public comment. So I'm sure everyone has questions, right? No questions? Okay. So I'm going to ask you all.
Got a hand over here.
Okay. Come on up, or you got a mic. Thank you. I'd like for you to introduce yourself and then ask your question, please.
Thank you. Mike Weinstein.
And who you're with, too. I want to know who in the room.
We're with the Kids Home Alliance, the city. I did a lot of analysis on money that would be kept in people's pockets if not go to government. And you assume that money would be churned in the community and more jobs and more this. Was that based upon the city? If the city got the money, they wouldn't have created more jobs and more churning and more, was it a zero government utilization of that money compared to the money that the family would churn?
That's a great question. I don't have a precise answer. I can't 100% say yes or no to you.
From what I understand, they're only looking at the one side of it. So from what I understand, it's looking more is if that information or if that money was just put back in the house, in the pocket of the family. It did not analyze what it would look like if it had gone into the government. So that's as I understand it. But as I mentioned, it's brand new. But I will certainly confirm and I can follow up to make sure that that is accurate.
Okay.
So,
hold on. I'd like, again, just say if you would introduce yourself or if you're with the organization, please let us know. Thank you.
My name is Kyle Mitchell. I'm with the Progressive Caucus. And same related question. I'm just kind of curious. If we start giving, you know, tax cuts or property tax cuts, how are we assured that this is going to trickle down to us? Because it sounds very similar to trickle-down economics, and I don't believe that handing, you know, Jeff Bezos $1 million is going to make the books any cheaper.
Well, I mean, I think what you're looking at is the direct impact to those families that would immediately have discounted rents. When I very first started working in housing, I actually worked at an affordable tax credit housing community. What you're looking at, those are required to, you have to have an income level below a certain median income. So as he mentioned, what the government comes out with the regulations, which says, based on the number of people that live in a house, there's a income level that's allowable. So you are targeting those people that desperately need that help. So it's not that somebody who is making $60,000 that only wants to pay $900 in rent would be able to qualify for that. There are specific guidelines that say I have to be able to show my income and my income can prove that I am under this level and that now I am able to have access to this housing. So it's targeted. It's targeting those people that specifically need that information. So you're not necessarily looking at, like, it's not opening up the additional housing. You know, those units are targeted for those families that are within that income level.
Yeah. Sorry if I wasn't clear. I guess I'm just more or less asking, what is the assurance that with the property tax cut, it's okay, with the property tax cut.
Yeah, we're recording, so we have to have that in. Thank you.
What is the assurance that with this property tax cut, you will see the money go back into the tenant's pocket?
Well, because they're paying less in rent. So again, instead of them having to pay the $1,500 in rent, they're only paying $900 in rent.
I think I want to try to help clarify this conversation. I
sure.
think what the gentleman is asking is, how is he assured that the rents will be reduced through this effort? And if I'm not mistaken, the answer to that is that it's a requirement to have these units available at a lower rent rate for that property tax reduction.
Yes, I'm sorry if I wasn't clear with that. It is required. So to receive the property tax discount, you are required to have those amount of units set aside at that discounted rent, and that has to be at that lower tax point or income level. So it's not that they could just choose not to do it. If they're going to get the tax break, if they're getting that break, they are required to set aside those units. And the one I was using was an example. The municipalities would be able to tailor whatever they wanted that to be. 25% is a break, you know, more or less. They could require more units that would have to be lower income housing. So you could say we're going to do a 50%, but you would require 50% of your units to be lower income. So it is required. It's not an optional thing. It would be, if they were to move forward with that, it would be required.
Thank you.
Hi, Cindy Funkhauser, CEO of Sulzbacher. I want to thank you, Dr. Jaffe, for some of the things that you said. Housing is a human right. Everyone deserves housing. And I think, you know, when I'm listening to all of this, which is very depressing, my net. But when I'm listening to all of this, the thing that sticks out the most to me is the 90% of our city that is zoned only for single-family housing. That's astounding, and I think that's low-hanging fruit, A. But B, and I do feel so sorry for city council, because I have to sit in city council meetings a lot. The NIMBY problem is alive and well in Jacksonville, Florida. Every time I'm at a meeting, there are people with different colored shirts in there protesting, many times market rate beautiful projects that are trying to be put into their districts. So I would love for us to investigate across the country how other cities are overcoming the NIMBY problem, because for me, that's one of the biggest problems we have in building affordable housing in Jacksonville. Just Just some comments.
Any other questions?
My name is Christina Kittle. I'm with Florida Rising, Jacksonville Community Action Committee, Florida for All. I had another point, but I wanted to bring up with the 90% or 91%. So a couple of things that makes me nervous about that is we're using building apartments as a solution to our historic districts. You know, I already have a place where I live. I just think it should remain affordable and not raise when I go to re-sign my lease. I don't want to have to then look into workforce housing or moving into a new development. That honestly, it sounds like they cater to people who are moving from the Northeast with Northeastern incomes into Jacksonville, and that's what's driving the rates up. Maybe I misunderstood that, but that's what it seems like. And if we're comparing to that, then we need to look at other things like raising the wages in Jacksonville. But keeping it on housing, you know, it's just like we're not like Orlando. We are not like Miami. You know, we're not a service city. We don't have theme parks and a bunch of jobs like that. We don't have public transportation, and we do have protected historically black districts that we just need to invest more into and keep affordable. So, instead of using the housing as the way to do that, I've also said that Jacksonville should look at the property taxes, because, if I am an investor and I'm coming in or I'm looking at moving into Jacksonville and seeing that it's, somewhat, the same property tax throughout the entire city, I would start looking into areas like the historic districts and start thinking, let's build up in here and do everything that you said. A different way around that could be to have designated opportunity zones like the historic districts where we keep it lower there, and then have investors, and then maybe raise it in other places. So if I'm a business owner and I see, hey, you know, it costs more money to, if I'm a business owner and I come to Jacksonville and I see it costs the same to open my business everywhere, I'm gonna go where there's already guaranteed business and where people already have money. But if I see it's lower to open in one of those areas that's being more neglected, it would be more of an incentive to open there, but you would have to have some kind of protection for the people living there, because I feel like what's happening is people are coming in and gentrifying the entire areas and then kicking us out. I already lost my home last year, and now I just moved into a new place, and in November we're keeping up. There's three units on my street that have been sitting vacant for months, so the units exist. But the pricing is ridiculous. So it's if we're keeping up with that, it's directly next door. If we're trying to keep up with that, my rent for my one-bedroom apartment is going to go up by $520 by November. So it's really impossible when we're facing that to even be patient and listen to any of these other plans, when we just can't keep the rent stable right now. We really do have to talk more about rent stabilization so that we can even have the mindset to be open to these ideas. Because a lot of what everybody's saying is awesome, and I love that this is happening, because this is the right step in the right direction, especially because in Florida Rising, my colleagues in Orlando, in Orange County, they just got the rent stabilization thing passed, and they are facing backlash. People are saying the city needs to do more research on it, so I'm glad that we're taking the step ahead of that, so that we're more prepared. But it is impossible for people facing their housing being taken away from them to even contribute meaningful things to that. So, you know, I guess that wasn't a question, it's more of a comment. I'm sorry.
I have a question in the back, Mercedes.
Housing is healthcare, so don't confuse why I'm here. I love this, Dr. Jaffe, Mr. Alexander, we finally meet face to face, and Ms. Lindsay, thank you all for your presentations. the one item that I'm sure will come up and be added to the discussion along the way is around heirs' properties and tax certificates and all this stuff where others are coming into these same zip codes that Dr. Jaffe mentioned and gobbling up properties from unsuspected homeowners who don't understand the fact that they may be owing the city $2,000. They can get this shiny toy of $20,000 and that developer sells it for $70,000.
And then someone like the young lady from Canton. So please be sure to include that in the topics that you want. Thank you.
I do have a question, Mr. Alexander, if you don't mind. I'm sorry, Justin Garrett, I'm here with the National Association of Residential Property Managers, what a mouthful. Mr. Alexander, did you state that only 46% of the vouchers that are available are currently being utilized? Did I hear that correctly?
Underneath the emergency housing voucher program, the EHVs, not our overall program. Our overall program is at 96%, but the EHVs just came out about a year ago, and it's taken some time to get them moving forward. But they are moving forward, and that's not because they haven't been utilized. They just started them a year ago.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yes, sir. In the
Good morning, I'm Lorraine Husband, the Vice President of Public Policy at City Northeast Florida, and also housing affects the ability of people to afford food, right? So that's why I'm here, because housing is the biggest predictor of whether people being off food lines or not, and their wages. But what I wanted to ask our panelists is, has anybody studied alternative housing solutions? Because this single family unit as the American dream, it's not attainable for most of us anymore. And also in light of the fact that the earth is finite, we don't have any more land. So why aren't we looking at co-housing solutions as alternatives? Just a question.
I didn't hear the first part of that question clearly.
And that was not just to you, Mr. Alexander, but I was saying, why aren't we, are we not looking at co-housing solutions as alternatives? Because single-family units only support single families. Yet, we know countries around the world are adopting co-housing solutions where several families can live together in this huge housing. We have, like, I live in Springfield. Our houses are huge. We could probably support three families in one house as a housing alternative, because we do not have any more land to build any more houses.
I got it. We have been looking at that. There's some models that exist in California, and we've been looking at it specifically in terms of vouchers, because some folks in terms of like New York, Seattle, California, where it's hard to find single housing at, where you can get more of a bang with your buck if they had more than one voucher at the property. So, yes, we've been looking at that.
Right. Well, we're going to go to public comments. Does anyone have any comments? Mr. Sivakas. Same thing. Your name. You have cards? Oh, thank you. I was okay.
Go ahead. Let Alex go.
Okay. Alex, if you would fill out a card afterwards. Okay.
Alex Sivakas, JWB Real Estate Capital. We are a local developer. Actually focuses a lot on affordable housing. A lot of the housing that we build is affordable to individuals that make 60% or 80% of AMI. So I guess more workforce than low-income affordable housing. But I completely agree with the fact that it is a huge impediment to having affordable housing, to having 91% of Jacksonville zone single-family. There was much less of an affordable housing problem in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, when most of our neighborhoods looked like Springfield or like Murray Hill, and you had what's called missing middle housing. So nowadays, what gets built is either single-family homes, sometimes townhomes if you're lucky, or giant apartment complexes. And that's not how neighborhoods used to be built. If you go to Springfield, you have a single-family home next to a quad, next to an eight-unit apartment complex, next to another single-family home. And what that does is it enables a wide variety of housing price points and sizes. Because in an eight-unit apartment complex, your units are only 600 square feet, and so they are much less expensive. But you can also have a 2,000-square-foot single-family home that a family wants to live in. And not only does that increase the supply of housing, it also gets people of different socioeconomic backgrounds living on the same street, which I think could solve a lot of other problems. It's not a housing issue, but I think that going towards really looking at how do we build that missing middle housing back in Jacksonville again? This isn't revolutionary. We used to do it. Would be a great solution. And the other thing is that housing affordability is, in my opinion, purely a supply and demand issue. If you have more supply, that will drive pricing down as opposed to if you didn't have that supply. So even a brand new luxury apartment complex at the beach makes housing in Jacksonville overall more affordable. Economics 101, pricing is only driven by supply and demand. And yes, if Dr. Jaffe might disagree with me a little bit. But absent large owners colluding, which yes,
there's price fixing. We have to make an assumption. Yes, okay. That's the first assumption. What are the other assumptions? Perfect information.
I can't wait to be on a panel with you in a little bit. So
you're next time.
and so I 100% agree with what Cindy was saying earlier as well about NIMBYism. That when we have groups getting together and opposing an apartment complex, and then the next week they're in an affordable housing meeting saying we need more affordable housing, those two things are directly contradictory. You can't have both. And so any way that we can build with more density to increase housing supply will get us more housing affordability. To Dr. Jaffe's point, it's not the only solution, and maybe not a comprehensive solution, but it's a huge part of the issue because that's how you get market rate affordable housing and how you can build housing without giant tax breaks or giant government subsidy, which is, in my opinion, the real way to solve the problem. So I have a lot more to say, but I'll stop there and somebody else. Thank you.
So you know Dr. Jaffe wants to respond to that, right? Okay, Dr. Jaffe.
Read my article in the folio. That's the first thing, just to straighten your, you know. I know you took an economics class, but it was in a business school, so that's problematic to begin. But my other point would, I think you are right about the missing middle. I think this is something we are going to be discussing. It's something I hope we can think about seriously as we move forward, because that is a critical aspect, as well as high-density housing. Just increasing supply will not automatically do that, but I do think those other alternatives have to be explored and have to be developed. So we do agree on that, Alex.
We got a young lady over here wants to speak, and we got a few other hands up now. We're not quite public comment yet. I think we're still back in discussion.
Okay.
Who's over here? There you go.
Hi, my name is Maria, and I represent the Theory of Change table. Several organizations on that table, JCAC, Florida Rising, Northside Coalition, many others. I just want to, refute the point about supply and demand. You can keep increasing the supply, but every time you build another luxury housing unit, or any time we allow these developers to come in and start charging whatever price they feel like or whatever the market dictates, it just takes affordability out of the hands of those people and all the neighborhoods nearby, because then all the other landlords decide, oh, well, the rent is going up in the area. I am literally someone that has happened to. I used to live in the lofts at La Villa, which was an income-controlled tax credit opportunity. They built lofts at Jefferson Station right next to it, which is a luxury apartment complex, which is laughable because it's exactly the same housing, just maybe a little bigger and some nicer amenities, but they were charging like double the rent. So they raised our rent three times up to the maximum allowable by the state. So the market can't correct itself out of this situation. Like, yes, we can build more because, yes, we do need that missing middle housing for folks that don't want to live in, you know, big apartment complexes or, you know, can't do the single family housing. But we have to ensure that the housing stays affordable for the residents of Jacksonville that are living here. The residents that are, like, day-to-day have made Jacksonville for generations the city that it is. We can't count on these. I don't have a Northeast salary to pay, you know, increasing rent. And we have to, I hope that we remain in service to longtime Jacksonvillians who, you know, unfortunately just can't afford this high of rent. We can't compete with these people from the Northeast. So what are we supposed to do? Just go on a mass exodus out of the state? Y'all need us here, so please, we need an action on stabilizing the rents. Thank you.
Thank you. It looks like.
Also, I do want to respond to JWB because JWB is exactly the reason why my rent is increased. We have four apartment complexes that are, you know, very modest, and the rent has gone up by $500, $600. So in November, because JWB bought out those units next to my unit, my rent will also go up that much. That does not help at all. That's not a solution. So we need to really look. It should. The renters should not be the ones to front the bill because investors want to pay lower taxes or whatever it is that's in y'all's plan. You have to think about the people who are living this and are facing homelessness now, right immediately, like by the end of this year.
Okay, I want us to get back on track because I want to go with these cards. So Neach, if you're going to speak, Christine, please fill out a card for me or your comment. So I'd like to, Michael, Marcus Hill. Oh, hey, Marcus. Could you take Marcus the microphone, please?
Where's Marcus?
Thank you. Allow me a moment to shift your focus just slightly and then you can come back to this main conversation. But my name is Marcus Hale. I'm with the Literacy Alliance of Northeast Florida. And while the focus today has been on affordable housing and maybe there'll be opportunities to broaden that discussion down the road, I wanted to offer our expertise from the Literacy Alliance today to the committee on using housing opportunities to also further education and workforce development for adults. I particularly like to thank Mr. Alexander for his work with the Housing Authority. We've been working with them on some programs at the Housing Authority sites for education. And actually, just last week, we had one of our students come in and help her read her forms and paperwork for the Housing Authority, and then two others just got their GEDs. So there's a lot of really great work going on within housing developments, and we'd like to continue to be a part of that. All of our partnerships can be models for how to complement housing solutions with other services to provide new opportunities for adults and families trying to get back on their feet through housing. So discussion.
Thank you, Marcus, for sharing. John Gritzelman? I can't read the...
Yeah.
And Dr. Is John?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hey, good morning, everybody. My name is John Gislison. I represent D.R. Horton. We're a large national home builder and real estate developer. I just want to talk a little bit, and again, thank you guys for the opportunity to allow us to be here to talk about this, because something that I'm very passionate about, especially not something that you typically see from a large real estate developer. And Dr. Jaffe, I did take a lot of economics classes, but I went to a liberal arts school, so hopefully that helps give me a little bit of leeway here. One of the things that I think that is a legitimate actionable item that we can focus on is development regulations that help or that hinder developers from creating affordable projects. One of the things that I struggle with, and as Alex mentioned, there's a lot of NIMBYism in Jacksonville, and that prevents speed to market of units, and that definitely affects the supply of housing, whether it's apartments, whether it's single-family, multifamily. It doesn't really matter. I think that we need to figure out a way to reduce some of the development regulations that the city of Jacksonville has in order to timely approve of projects. And I think we also have to also understand why we're here now. A lot of the data that was focused on was you know, the last 2 years. We are in a rising cost, rising interest rate market. And because of that, my development costs have gone up over 50%. That's directly affecting the affordability of supply. So helping to reduce some of those those development regulations will also help to reduce the cost that goes into creating these developments, because I don't think that we need government incentives all the time. I think that public-private partnerships in this way will help to reduce the price of housing across the board, whether it's for rent or market rate for sale stuff. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Jesse Spratley.
Jesse Spratley with the Northeast Florida Builders Association. Thank you again for letting us be here. I'm here representing our 1,200 business members here in the Northeast Florida area who work in the home building construction industry and construction in general. And I'm excited to hear talk about addressing zoning and also what Alex mentioned about the missing middle housing and how do we bring that. Because our zoning codes, we're building houses for a demographic that doesn't exist anymore. Our zoning code is mired in the 80s and 90s. We're building for families with 2.5 kids. That is not who our home buyers are anymore. We're looking at dual income, no kids. We're looking at retirees who are looking to downsize, and we are not able to build the housing they want because our zoning code won't allow it. And I understand that NIMBYism is out there, and it's strongly pushed back against that because the idea that a smaller house will bring down the value of my house is very, I get it. You know, I understand that I'm a homeowner. I understand that thought process. But I also live next to a quadplex, and it has not brought down my housing value. It is okay for those housing types to exist next to each other, but we have to allow it. And the way you allow that is you allow it by right. Put it in the zoning code that someone can go up to a quadplex on their lot. And that's how, if we're going to affect that change, get those smaller lots and then become more affordable, and then open up. And that's the thing. It's a chain of command. People think, oh, but you're only building that luxury apartment complex. Well, where did that luxury apartment complex person come from? Myself, I'm in what I consider a first-time homebuyer house. I have two kids. I'm ready to move up, but I can't. I need the person in front of me to move up so I can move up so then my house comes on the market and becomes available for someone who wants that first-time homebuyer house. And with that, I look forward to more of these meetings.
Thank you, Jesse. Justin Garrett.
I'm very involved in this. I think it's a conversation that absolutely needs a lot of attention. So again, Justin Garrett, I'm with Property Managers. It's the National Association of Residential Property Managers. So I'm the bad wolf at the door. I'm the property manager, right? But that said, we're actually on the same team because without tenants, I don't have a job, right? And without tenants who can afford housing, our units won't exist and our job won't exist. So I do want to address the statements about the immediate control, it's called rent control, what it is, an immediate, right now solution, which seems to make a lot of sense because it is a right now need. What I have seen firsthand is an absolute counterproductive effect of legislation that is anti-landlord legislation, which doesn't do me any good, and it doesn't do the residents any good. And what has happened historically, and it can be seen time and time and time again, is that if there is anti-landlord legislation that is put into place, the landlords will sell that property, probably to someone from the Northeast who can afford it at a massive profit, and through a process which is called 1031 exchange, it's a tax process that's allowed the code, they will then use that money and buy property somewhere where rent control does not exist. So, yeah, okay, we're going to stake it to the landlords and get rent control, but what actually happens is we end up shooting ourselves in the foot because then that house is no longer in the rental pool, which reduces the supply. And there's a lot of talk about supply and demand, but I think we can all agree less housing is not the answer. So what I have seen firsthand in a significant manner is legislation passed, whether it was rent control, landlord permits, property minimum requirements, whatever it might be. And in my business, the phone starts ringing and the owners are saying, it's time to sell. So I just want to put that thought process out there that they still have that option available to them, and restricting the people who are providing the housing is very counterproductive. It's like saying we're going to shut down the grocery store because people are hungry. So just think about that when we have these conversations that I don't know the answer to, but I do know that reduced housing it exacerbates the issue and it doesn't help resolve it.
So that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Catherine Freeman. She's in the back.
Hi, everyone. My name is Catherine Freeman, and I'm with Habijacks. I'd like to provide our perspective. It's a unique one because we are both a builder, and we provide services to low-income families in Northeast Florida. The zip codes that were mentioned as targeted by institutional investors of 06, 08, 09, 54 have been our primary building footprint for the past few decades. We've built over 2,300 homes for families in Northeast Florida for the past 30 years. Some of that recently has been multifamily. We have Legacy 8 over on the corner of Beaver and Acorn, which is our first townhome project. We also recently just built Jacksonville's first tiny house community. 50 affordable units were recently brought into the market. That was a partnership between us, Affordable Housing, Sulzbacher, Gateway, and Councilperson Priestley Jackson, who was a great partner for us because nothing like that had ever been done in the city before. We're grateful for that partnership in making that happen. There was NIMBYism present there, but she was able to hold forums for her community, explain how that development would benefit that neighborhood. And so we have over 50 folks who were in desperate need of transitional affordable housing to have a home of their own, some of them for the very first time. We're not just talking about with the zoning issue, zoning from the 70s and 80s, we're talking about zoning from the 40s and 50s when redlining was present. For further reading, I recommend The Color of Law by Richard Rothstein that argues that zoning was intentional. There was active racism at play in determining where people could and could not live. And we're still seeing decades later how that is borne out in our city. So I think that's something to keep on in mind as we move forward with these discussions. Our construction costs have increased by around $50,000 per house since the beginning of the pandemic. As an affordable home builder that serves families at 30 to 80% of the median income, that puts us in quite a vice when we're talking about keeping homes actually affordable for our families. So we face some of the same issues that our friends at NEFBA face, and I will say that NEFBA was also one of our partners on the Tiny Houses Project too. Our appraisals in those four zip codes that I mentioned earlier are coming back in the 170 to 180 range, which is pretty outrageous for those areas. Just a year or two ago, those were coming back in the 120s, 130s. So our family salaries are not increasing at those same rates. So they have more urgent needs than ever before, and our sense of urgency about keeping our housing affordable is more urgent than ever before. So I hope that in these conversations moving forward, we're keeping the families in need first, because they're the ones who are facing impossible choices about do I keep the lights on or do I feed my kids. I also am curious to learn more about the allocations for the American Rescue Act funding. The city was given $171 million. Only $4 million of that went to affordable housing, and that was for two specific projects and not for any comprehensive housing plan. So there was $50 million for wastewater infrastructure. There was $24 million for road resurfacing. So for only $4 million of that to be designated for affordable housing, I'd really like to learn more about how we can
All right. Thank you so much. We have about 20 more minutes or about 15 more minutes, and I want to make sure that we're out of here. So our next speakers, if you all would take no longer than 3 minutes to ask your questions. I will now have Beth Mixon. She's up front, Mercedes.
Thank you so much. I'm Beth Mixon. I'm with Family Promise of Jacksonville. One issue that I have not heard us discuss, and it could probably bear fruit quickly, is the issue with the increase in expectations for security deposit for apartments, the increase in apartment application fees. Anecdotally, for our families, what we're hearing is apartment landlords, I shouldn't say apartments because it's both houses and it's landlords, are looking for three times the rent in application fees. They're wanting the tenant to have three times the rent for income to be approved. Last week, anecdotally, we had a family that was told they could be on the waiting list for a $150 fee. So that does not even get you processed. It just means you're on the waiting list. And if you are struggling, that $150 could feed your children. It could pay a utility bill. It could put gas in your vehicle.
Thank you so much, Beth. Cal Mitchell.
Yeah, Kyle Mitchell with the Progressive Caucus again. I just wanted to say that I think it's kind of funny that all of these management companies are now NIMBY supporters. That to me sounds kind of fishy. It seems like you want to have more units to rent out. And I do want to touch base on the supply and demand thing again. Supply and demand requires there be a supply and a demand. And if there is no more supply because real estate investors are buying them up, I don't see how that has anything to do with, or I don't see how building more properties is going to solve that. I feel like you're just going to continue buying them up, and we're still going to have this shortage, even if you have 80% of them already. Thank you.
Justin Foster.
Hi, Justin Foster. I'm with the Jack.
Hold on. If you...
Hi, Justina Foster. I'm with the Jacks Rental Housing Project at UNF. And I wanted to add what Justin here had to say about anti-landlord legislation. And I thought he made a really good point about it leading to smaller landlords selling their property. And something I think that we could look into to prevent this would be some form of regulation on foreign corporate landlords. Because if I'm remembering the data correctly off the top of my head, in 2020, the percentage of rental housing property acquired by foreign corporate landlords on the national level was 11%, and while in Florida, it's 20%, which is almost double that.
Okay. Christina Kittle?
I'm glad you brought it up, Joseph. We're going to talk on that. But, yeah, that's the point, because in Florida Rising, that's in the legislation that our group wrote that did get passed in Orange County, and is being challenged, of course, but that there's all of this has been taken into account, because there's a lot of research being backed from both sides, you know what I mean? It's not, oh, the spooky landlord that we all hate. It's, okay, we get it, you maintain our property, but we just can't afford to live here anymore. So, like, I don't know which legislation was being referenced prior, but the one that we're bringing to the table definitely, you know, talks about outside investors who come in and, like, you know, corporate investors who cause the other landlords like mine to have to, or feel like they have to raise their rent to keep up with them, with, like, the big corporations that move in next door and rise the price. So it's like, we gotta really think about those kind of things. When we're saying rent control, it's not just, yeah, stop all rent. First of all, it's only for 12 months. That's legally as long as it can go. But within that 12 months, we can actually really dive into all of these other longer-term solutions and not have to stress out about, you know, losing our homes in the meantime, because it's really impossible. I'm usually way more composed, but it's very impossible with the stress of facing homelessness to even, like, really give the opportunity that, like, to hear what everybody's saying. I can't even talk today. Like, that's just where I'm at, you know, like, the stress is real. And then also, Florida Rising, I've been going to other apartments that have been facing the same thing and seeing ceilings falling in that haven't been repaired, mold issues, children literally playing in, like, holes, in, like, playing, you know, don't touch the lava, but in holes that exist in the apartment complexes. And people are just defeated. It's not that they don't want the changes. And then, you know, these things happen on work days where they can't show up. So it's like, it seems a little unfair because the people who are most impacted just actually cannot be here. And then I'm one of those people who has the opportunity to be here. And I know I come off as just sounding, you know, basic. Like, oh, just have rent control. It is what it is. But no, these organizations really have
thought of every preemption that could be possible, and you know, a ways that in the long term don't actually hurt us, but can help us in the immediate as well in the long term. So that's all I just wanted to add. Thanks.
Well, I want to thank everyone. Before we close up, I want to see if our panelists have closing remarks to what you've heard today and what has been presented. So, Lindsay, I'll give you an opportunity to share.
Thank you so much. Thank you all again for being able to be here. Again, we understand this is a problem. It's a critical problem in Jacksonville. I think there are many different solutions that can be considered and looked at. I think it's important that when we are making decisions that we're looking at balanced housing options and choices and data and what we can do and maybe some other cities and what other cities have done that have been successful at this, and really exploring different options. You know, we're excited to be a part of this and to be a part of the conversation.
Thank you. Dr. Jaffe.
Yeah, I'd just like to thank everyone for attending and for sharing your views. I think it's important. Also, again, I would appreciate any feedback on the conceptual framework and what's missing and what needs to be added in terms of getting input from all the stakeholders. I think what we've heard today, not just from me, but from the other speakers, is that we have some institutional capacity here with the Jacksonville Housing Authority, and I view that as a major strength or opportunity as a way to maybe incorporate some of the suggestions that have been made within an institutional apparatus. It's also important to have organizations like the First Coast Apartment Association. They're gathering a lot of important data, which are sharing with us, and I think that's important as well. We want to make decisions that are informed by the data, evidence-based, and any organization that is collecting data of this kind and can share it with us, I think we can make better decisions and hopefully at the end come up with some concrete recommendations, ultimately to address the problem. And in the future, I think at some of the meetings coming up, we will hear about public sector solutions where housing is not built for profit, but is designed to meet the needs of the residents of Jacksonville.
Thank you. Mr. Alexander.
Thank you. I just want to thank everyone for coming out. I thought it was a great discussion. I'm looking forward to working with everyone to try to resolve this problem. I think it's a major issue, and I'm just elated over the fact that everyone has a concern for it at this point. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilman Borland.
Allow me also to share my appreciation for all of you being here. And to the NIMBY issue, as the last 3 years, certainly serving on the Land Use and Zoning Committee and chairing it, 1 year and vice chair another year, I can certainly attest to the concerns of the neighborhoods and an appreciation for the fact that we need to see an evolution of our communities to address this issue. I think we got a little off track today in a couple of areas, but I think the essence and the issue and the severity of the issue, the scope of the issue, was evident today. And I think that's really what the intent of today's meeting was, to understand both in a qualitative and quantitative manner the challenge we've got ahead of us, and it's significant. There's no question about it, and I know it's not going to go away. So I appreciate the opportunity of y'all getting involved. This is not going to be a comfortable journey, as evidenced we saw today. But we have to go through this process. I'm counting each and every one of you staying in the game and being part of this conversation, because we are deliberate in developing some policies and practices and perhaps even structures that allows us to address this issue. So thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity.
So as I close up, you know, I want to, Noel, I would like for you to say something. I'm sorry, as one of our partners today.
No, can y'all hear me?
Push the button. No, just push it and let it go.
There it goes. Thank you. Sorry about that. I feel like I'm incompetent today. My name is Noel Cum. I'm Director of Planning for the Northeast Florida Regional Council, mostly speaking on behalf of Elizabeth Payne, our CEO. We're glad to be supporting this issue, as Councilman Boylan knows, with the two other issues that comprise the critical quality of life issues within Jacksonville, and we hope we can help make a difference. Thank you for including us.
And Councilwoman Moore Maury. Maury, did you like to say something as well?
Yes, ma'am. I know that this particular issue is the priority, really, in the city. And it is a multifaceted issue. It is not just one particular side. We have to look at it from all issues, especially from the zoning issue. And I'm a student by nature, teacher by profession. And I've made a list of, you know, problems, solutions, the different positions. And being one who came from my parents, we lived in a beautiful home in the Reball area. And then we had to move to Cleveland Arms, which is was a project. And then I seen my mom work her way so that she was able to take advantage of a city program to purchase her own home by herself. And then with my own particular situation, I understand and have been exposed to many of these aspects that you're talking about. And then my research for this particular area did not begin with this particular meeting. I've been researching this issue of lack of housing, affordable housing, for at least a year and a half. So I'm well aware of the different issues as far as the rent control. And we can't just say rent control. It has different steps to it. And there's a timeline that goes along with it. So once again, this is a very important issue. It's definitely a priority. And I thank everyone for being here today to express your interests. Thank you.
You're welcome. For my last words, you know, I want to say this is very, very important to me as well. This issue has been going on a long time, and especially since I've been in council, we've had different groups to come up. We can no longer just talk about it. We have to be a community who's willing to go outside of our boundaries and be innovative and be bold and have, you know, really conversations that might not be as comfortable, or those that have been in control of building and those that have been or lived in communities, for them to come out and share, you know, the disparities that are going on in our community. And one thing I can say today, I've been in a lot of meetings, and we've never had everyone in one room like this to have this conversation. I think it's healthy. I think we can't continue to do the same old things, because guess what? We get the same old results. And as the builders, we hear you. As the advocacies in the community, we hear you. I'm all in. As Ms. Murray, I grew up in public housing. I lived in public housing until my mom was able to move us out. And, you know, those of us that are in leadership positions, we've not always been in these positions. It's our experiences that have led to where we are. And so what I'm asking each of you all to do is come with an open mind. Those of you all that have relationships, because y'all know at the end of the day, in order to get change, it's about relationships. And it's about the willingness to go outside of your comfort zone and make a difference. It's also about navigating through the process. Because if it's easy, everybody, you know, wants to do it. But if we have the discussions to talk about redlining and discrimination and ways that we can come together to fix it, I think now is a good time. There are other cities and states. I know Cindy called me about some ideas that we can talk about. I will have some allocated time where we can talk about ideas, or if you want to send them to my office, I'll be happy to share my card with you afterwards, because most people that know me, I don't like to talk, okay? I want to implement. And we have to be intentional. So I'm depending on each of you, to help Dr. Jaffe and I to create a framework that can work not only for this committee, but also for our community. Because y'all know we can do anything that we want to do. Is that right? All right, so I look forward to y'all. We just getting into it. Make sure y'all come on September the 30th. We got something good for them, don't we, Dr. Jeffy?
Yes, we do.
Mm-hmm. So, again, y'all have a great weekend. And I want to tell you also, I'm sorry, thank you, that all of the presentations that you saw today will be online as well as the minutes. So you can kind of keep up with everything that's going on. Y'all have a great weekend. Thank you.
Nice to see you.